Good morning, Your Honors. If I could please reserve 2 minutes. May it please the Court, I'm Kevin March here on behalf of Chad Sullivan. The issue here is Mr. Sullivan's sole defense was whether pepper spray was or was not a noxious substance, a jury question. He conceded he committed assault. The only issue is the degree, whether it was second or fourth. 4 times he was denied the only qualified expert that defense counsel was able to find, Cameron Logren, to render an opinion that pepper spray was not a noxious substance, that it caused no permanent physical harm, that it and the reason why this was denied over and over again was a misunderstanding of the law. Essentially, the King County Department of Public Defense opined that pepper spray, as a matter of law, was a noxious substance, and therefore he didn't need a defense on this element. Or the second reason is money. And when money determines the expert that you can get, it turns access to the judicial process into a sham, and that's exactly what happened in Mr. Sullivan's case.
What case do you rely on for the proposition that a court, using its discretion, can't take costs into account?
There is no case that I've been able to find that says explicitly that costs can never be taken into account, and that's not necessarily our argument. In certain cases, perhaps costs should be taken into account. However, we're relying on Ake v. Oklahoma, and that case found an equal protection violation for the complete denial of an expert based on cost. By extension, in this case, where the expert was denied partially because of cost, it's a similar equal protection violation, Your Honor.
But the court did find another expert, and that expert did testify.
The expert that was provided to Mr. Sullivan was a poor substitute, a substantively inferior expert. So that also shows that cost was the primary consideration for denying Mr. Sullivan his expert. Mr. Logman had 5 patents for various pepper spray formulas. Mr. Logman had testified numerous times and was a trusted consultant for law enforcement and military in terms of chemical agents. The guy that they provided Mr. Sullivan owned his own self-defense company and did demos for pepper spray at shopping malls. They weren't comparably situated experts, and because they weren't comparable, it still violated Mr. Sullivan's equal protection right to present an expert in his defense. And again, go ahead.
Well, didn't he testify, though, that there were no long-term effects?
He actually conceded that there could be long-term effects if a person had a pre-existing condition. And in the offer of proof that defense counsel made about Mr. Logman's expertise, he wouldn't have conceded that same point. And again, the qualifications between these two experts were stark. A jury would be more likely to be persuaded by somebody with the credentials of Mr. Logman compared to the credentials of Mr. Walker. And in terms of whether cost, and we're certainly not arguing that.
That's kind of puts some cost out of the picture, doesn't it? Because it means every time that somebody goes to get an expert at public expense, they always get, you know, the doctor from the Mayo Clinic. They always get somebody from Harvard. They always get, you know, the top person, because they would be more convincing as far as their credentials are concerned.
Well, and we're not arguing.
A person with maybe just hands-on experience.
We're not arguing that cost can never be a consideration, but here, where the purpose of the expert was to dispute the only material fact in this case, which is whether pepper spray constituted a noxious substance, that if the court wishes to balance.
Then didn't they both then have to start from a point of view of knowing what a noxious substance is?
Well, a noxious substance was defined using the dictionary definition here, and it was defined as something that caused physical harm to living beings, or was harmful or destructive to living beings. Dr. Logman would have testified much more persuasively for the defense that it was not a harmful to living beings, and that was explicitly, as a designer of pepper spray himself, could have...
You mean that he would have testified that it wasn't harmful in terms of having long-term effects that lasted more than a day and caused great pain during the time that it was administered?
Correct. Yes.
So he would have said that whatever what happened in this case wasn't noxious, because my interpretation of noxious is it has to be something that lasts longer than that.
Correct. I mean, that the interpretation of noxious is whether it actually causes physical harm or destruction. And in this case, he would have testified that it didn't, and the jurors would have been more persuaded by the testimony of a doctor or Mr. Logman as opposed to Mr. Walker.
Did the state have a witness?
An expert witness? No, though several officers testified that they had been exposed to pepper spray during the course of their employment. And really, the issue isn't that cost can never be a consideration, but it requires some kind of balancing, and I believe the Ake court used the Matthews analysis to determine what that balancing should be in that case. And the balancing of costs, when the sole defense, the sole line of defense is whether or not this substance is noxious, it compels a more robust expert in those circumstances. And the experts at issue here for the defense are comparing apples and oranges, and the sole reason why, getting to the denials that the Department of Public Defense came up with, I mean, they were basically saying that, well, nobody's going to believe that pepper spray isn't a noxious substance, therefore this expert isn't reasonably necessary for the defense. The end.
Well, that's what they said at first, but then they did it pay for an expert.
Well,
I mean, you would have a stronger case, would you not, if they just said, oh, well, we don't think that your defense is viable, so go away.
Well, that's what they did do several times, and then for some reason changed their tune a month and a half before trial and said...
Well, wouldn't we go on the basis of what their final position was rather than their first reaction?
Well, I think that the first reactions are relevant to the whole process and demonstrate exactly how money played a role in the determination of which expert Mr. Sullivan was allowed to present.
But wouldn't we actually look at the Superior Court's decision? Because the Department's decisions were appealed to the Superior Court. The final one was appealed to the Superior Court.
Yes, and this court would look to the Superior Court one. However, the Superior Court one as well said this isn't a viable defense. And then we don't know what changed in the Department of Public Defense and what changed with the Superior Court that, lo and behold, oh, we were wrong, this is a viable defense, now we're going to give him the substantively inferior expert to fulfill our role of ensuring that Mr. Sullivan has an adequate defense.
Did the defense propose someone besides Mr. Walker who would meet in the middle ground somewhere?
Defense did not specifically. However, defense said that all the experts she was able to find, that Mr. Logan was by far the most qualified, and that other experts that were comparable cost even more money than he did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Ann Summers on behalf of the State of Washington. Under the Due Process Clause in Criminal Rule 3.1, an indigent criminal defendant is entitled to a competent expert at state expense when that expert is necessary to presenting an adequate defense. He is not entitled to the most expensive expert in the country when other experts are competent and available. I'd like to read from Aki versus Oklahoma, the U.S. Supreme Court case that established the right to expert assistance. While the court has not held that a state must purchase for the indigent defendant all the assistance that his wealthier counterpart might buy, it is often reaffirmed that fundamental fairness entitles indigent defendants to an adequate opportunity to present their claims fairly within the adversary system. To implement this principle, we have focused on identifying the basic tools of an adequate defense or appeal, and we have required that such tools be provided to those defendants who cannot afford to pay them. So we're talking about basic tools of an adequate defense. The expert at trial, Mr. Walker, was qualified to testify about the components of pepper spray and the effects of pepper spray. You do not have to have invented something to be able to competently testify about it. And the effects were really not in dispute. It causes an intense burning sensation. It causes your mucous membranes to swell. It causes shortness of breath, which then often causes fear, anxiety, and panic. It is intended to temporarily debilitate a person without causing any long-term damage to tissues. Both the police officers who had been trained and exposed to pepper spray and the three victims who testified as to the effects that they felt and the defense expert, in my view, were all consistent as to what the effects of pepper spray are. What it causes: great pain, great discomfort, physical manifestations including mucous membrane swelling, shortness of breath, and also intense burning, but it doesn't create long-term damage to the physical tissues. So the question was whether these effects met the definition of noxious that was given to the jury. Now, Mr. Sullivan's not challenging the sufficiency of the evidence, and he's not challenging the jury instructions. And the interesting thing about this case is, in my view, the facts were essentially undisputed, and the argument to the jury was basically a legal argument. Do you need physical pain to establish harm, physically harmful, or do you need some sort of lasting injury to establish physically harmful?
What about the argument that a doctor would might be more informative of this definition of noxious, what is noxious, versus Mr. Walker?
I just don't, it doesn't hold water here. I mean, the question is, what effects does pepper spray cause? And Mr. Walker was a certified pepper spray instructor. He was able to testify to those effects. The defense was able to make their argument that it was only pain. There's no lasting damage. But the problem with that argument is it wasn't sufficient under the instructions to the jury or the law under Washington. Bodily injury and bodily harm are defined as physical pain under the definitions. So I don't think...
Well, that definition, though, wasn't what they were looking at, or was it? I mean, as I understood the argument so far today, the jury was... Yeah. It was the definition of noxious that was given, which did not say lasting effects, and so it might or might not include lasting effects. And I take it that this was a situation where, you know, the jury has to refer to its own understanding of the English language to decide what the term, whether it encompasses lasting effects or not.
Yes, so noxious...
Could have been defined that way, maybe, but it wasn't, is your position.
So noxious... The term noxious is that the statute is not statutorily defined. So the court relied on a dictionary definition, which defines noxious as physically harmful. So there is no legislative support for the idea that you have to have lasting effects for something to be noxious.
Well, I suppose you could get into the argument that, well, it's put in the same sort of category in the statute in the same phrase as poison, so does poison have to have lasting effects?
No, but keep in mind, if you look at the statutory scheme, if you... administer poison, cause someone to ingest poison with the intent to, with great bodily harm,
right,
that's assault in the first degree.
I see.
This is assault in the second degree, so it's just the intent to commit bodily harm, which is just physical pain, is clearly statutorily defined as physical pain. You cause someone to ingest a noxious substance. Now,
like poison. I mean, in other words,
like a poison.
I realize I'm going beyond your briefs here, but is poison anywhere defined as something that has lasting effects, or can you ingest a poison and simply experience pain?
I would assume poison is, I don't know what the dictionary definition, I assume poison is something that will eventually cause death if you get enough of it, right? But we have two levels of assault here, and clearly the legislature has made a determination that you are more culpable if you cause someone to ingest a substance that is in some way harmful to them. And harmful means causing physical pain as well as lasting injury. And that statutory scheme makes sense. But the issue here, again, there's not a sufficiency claim, there's not a challenge to the jury instructions, it's just that Mr. Sullivan should have had a more expensive expert, and somehow that expert would have been better because he was the inventor of pepper spray. But if the question is, what effects does pepper spray have and does it cause pain, that was essentially undisputed. There's not, no expert could have really helped him argue to the jury that pepper spray, when it's sprayed right in your face and it's ingested into your nasal passages and into your mouth, is not physically harmful, because that's what it's intended to be. So Mr. Sullivan has not shown that the inventor of pepper spray was necessary for him to present an adequate defense. This court certainly cannot say that the trial court did abuse its discretion in deciding that the King County did not have to pay thousands of dollars to hire the inventor of pepper spray for Mr. Sullivan to present his defense, which I believe was legally inadequate anyway, that somehow the effects of pepper spray are not physically harmful.
What other choices were before the trial court? Was it just these two individuals, Walker and...
Well, the way I understand it, they said, we're not going to pay for the inventor of pepper spray, particularly since he couldn't come to Seattle. He would have to have testified telephonically. So you should look into finding someone else, local, who's not as expensive. And then I believe the defense attorney came up with Mr. Walker.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Whether or not it's legally sufficient for the jury to have found pepper spray as a noxious substance is beside the point. The point is, it was a question of fact. The jury was entitled to receive evidence to answer that question of fact. And the definition, the state's claiming that bodily harm is defined and that's all that matters. Well, bodily harm is defined in the WPIX. However, that goes to Mr. Sullivan's intent to assault and whether he intended bodily harm. The only definition that was in dispute in this case is the definition of noxious, and that meant physically harmful or destructive to living beings. Now, physically harmful or destructive, there's just as much a good argument that physically harmful and destructive means something more than 30 to 60. Physically harmful or destructive. Yes, that it means something beyond 30 to 60 minutes of pain from exposure to pepper spray. The jury was certainly welcome to determine that in Mr. Sullivan's case. The reason perhaps they didn't is because they weren't presented with a qualified expert who could discuss at length why pepper spray was in fact designed not to be physically harmful or destructive to living beings. And indeed, that's what Mr. Logman's testimony would have been. He had, again, he would have been more persuasive to the trier of fact on that issue. And the reason why he was denied is because, essentially, because of the state's economic concerns. And when that's the case, when money is determinative of the expert you get to present in your defense, it is an equal protection violation because a wealthier counterpart would have been able to present Mr. Logman's testimony without that kind of burden. So we'd ask this court to reverse and remand for a trial where he's allowed to present his full defense. Thank you.
Thank you.